Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced almost 5 years, and together we have a fantastic, amazing daughter who's doing great and thriving. And today I have my guest co-host, Nicole Knowlton, joining me again. And Nicole, if you don't mind introducing yourself to our audience, that would be fantastic.
Sure. Hi, I'm Nicole. I'm an autistic neurodivergent therapist, also with ADHD. I was married in a neurodiverse relationship for 12 years. And have two amazing neurodivergent children who are the loves of my life.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Isn't that great when you have a great relationship with your kids? It's so it's so terrific. Well, today, Nicole, we're going to talk about another really important topic that I haven't really addressed much on the podcast, and that's about reprocessing our family memories, knowing that we didn't know we were in a neurodiverse family, and how that can impact and affect our neurodiverse intimate relationships. So I know this is going to be really helpful to a lot of folks because there are so many adults out there that will never, ever, ever self-identify or be assessed, evaluated, or diagnosed. And, you know, I know that I grew up in a family where my father was autistic. We never knew. He passed away in 2005. My mother threatened him with divorce more than once. And I saw how much they loved each other, but they had ongoing challenges that I think if they would have understood they were in a neurodiverse marriage, it would have made a difference. And now when my sister and I look at my father's parenting style and the difference between how he parented and my mother parented, it just all makes sense. So I would love for you to share maybe a little bit about your family of origin or what you want to talk about relating to this topic, and then I'll share a little bit more. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the timing is excellent considering we're just coming out of the holidays, you know, several weeks ago. And there is a joke that I read recently that January is for therapists like tax season for accountants. Yeah, they're spending all the, you know, the month of December likely planning and being around family and then the recovery. So
I love that. I love that.
I have a lot of thoughts and views on reprocessing, you know, neurodivergence in our families and that recognition that if it is genetic and you know, receive a diagnosis or a family member receives a diagnosis or a child, starting to look back at things is incredibly eye-opening and healing and just so interesting. I mean, we could talk for many hours on this topic, but yes, I have, I definitely appreciate it. And, you know, my father passed in 2009, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure that he was on the spectrum and not diagnosed, mm-hmm. and it looked like something very different, and I'm sure that there are, you know, likely other members of my family, and just when you look at it from that different perspective, it just changes things in a way where it's much easier, I think, to make peace with maybe some some of the parenting that you received, or understanding the dynamic of your parents and maybe why a marriage didn't work out, or there was a lack of intimacy or fighting, a lack of emotional affection in the family, just so many different areas that can be affected if you have, you know, neurodivergence in your family. And this topic is really exciting to talk about.
Yeah, Nicole, I think this is going to be helpful to a lot of folks, because I think reparenting is a term that is used a lot on social media and YouTube and whatever. And I think it's so important. But when you're able to reparent yourself and also work on forgiving your parents because there was unknown neurodiversity and they didn't understand how their brains were wired and they didn't understand why they had maybe sensory sensitivities or different ways of showing emotional affection or affection period, or maybe they didn't like to hug or touch you and you took it all personal, and you know how much trauma you may have experienced in your family of origin, and you know, not know what the cause of some of it was. I'm not saying all of it, but I will share something with the listeners, and I don't think I've shared this before, but it's been something that's impacted me maybe in the last year and a half. When my father was alive, and again, he died in 2005, he was young, he was 64. Many, many years prior to his death, I want to say when I was in elementary school, he basically disowned his only brother and his father. His mother had passed in her 50s. And my sister and I couldn't really understand what happened. And he never really explained it to us. He kind of just said, you know, I just can't handle them anymore, kind of thing. And I can laugh about it now, but it wasn't funny, because I have three first cousins that I met, like, you know, two times in my life when I was an elementary school age kid. And recently, my father's brother, my uncle, who's in his mid to late 80s, reconnected with my sister and I. And at first, we were hesitant to reconnect with him because we didn't exactly know what happened with my father and him. But when my sister and I talked about it, we realized that it was probably because of the unknown neurodiversity, that he just couldn't handle certain emotions and conversations. And because my uncle likes to connect, he likes to talk, he likes to get together, and I don't think my father could handle it. And so now we've reconnected. I mean, all the adult children are adults. We're in our 50s, right? And, you know, I'm looking and seeing that there's probably neurodiversity there, you know, and we lost out on, you know, 50 plus years of a relationship with all these folks. And so if anybody who's listening, this resonates, I feel it's an opportunity, and I'm even getting a little teary-eyed as I'm saying this. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to forgive. Right. And begin to heal, because if communicating with a family member or the emotional wherewithal that's necessary to be in that relationship is difficult for somebody who does not understand that they're neurologically different from maybe the majority of the family, that you can look back and say, it wasn't anybody's fault. You know, it just, there were things people didn't know back then. Do you have any, you know, thoughts? Is there anything that you can share with the audience that might be impactful related to your extended family or your immediate family?
Oh, yes. I, listening to your story, it really hits close to home. My father died. He died young as well. He was 65. And he was living such a tortured life because you know, he had some traits. He was brutally honest. He would just say things with no filter. And the closest people to him were family members, you know, his siblings that were more like him, that understood and accepted and sort of embraced his differences. And I just remember feeling sad for my dad that, you know, he was isolated socially. And I was hurt a lot by some of the things that he would say. And there would just be really brutally honest things, but, you know, maybe as a teenage girl, you're not prepared to hear.
Right.
And I think about, you know, the way that so many adults have grown up and not been diagnosed. So many people in our country that just haven't identified that. And it makes me really sad, because I know that had we had those resources and that information, life could have been much different. It wouldn't, I think there's a lot of people out there that wouldn't have gone through life without separating from their family, or feeling like an outsider, or being rejected, and just, you know, being embraced for who they are. And as a child of a parent that, you know, that struggled with finding the right words, I think that listening to this podcast right now, for many people, I think that if you look back, you may see those interesting family members that might have, you know, hurt your feelings or said something inappropriate or behaved in a way that was a little different. And maybe we internalize that to be a reflection of us or a reflection of their view of us. And we suffered a little bit, or we suffered a lot. And now we can sort of identify, you know, a family history based on, you know, some additional information or inquiry. And I think it lightens our hearts, or at least for me, I can't speak for everyone, but it provides just this opportunity to forgive and understand and accept and have compassion. And, you know, just, I think, just try to focus on, you know, healing and bridging those relationships that maybe are distant now or are uncomfortable at the holidays because you're not sure what's going on with, you know, some of our family members.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I think, you know, one of the other things that I think is important for folks to think about is, and we can talk about it in relation to the holidays, but maybe just family gatherings as a whole. I think there may be, you know, neurodivergent family members who, when they get together with the family, their alcohol consumption goes up, or their smoking goes up, or their overeating is, you know, exacerbated, or something, you know, part of their, you know, coping mechanisms, or maybe stimming increases, you know, something they do that the family like looks at them like, why are they doing that? Like, you know, where a foot gets tapped nonstop for hours during a family meal, or somebody's kind of, you know, jumping up and down or moving their hand or whatever is something that might be different than the rest of the family. Those kind of things might be exacerbated during those family gatherings. And oftentimes, you know, it can turn into a negative experience. But when you look at your family, or even your extended family, your family of origin, but your extended family, through a neurological lens, hopefully you can have a little bit more grace and compassion for what might be going on, because socializing, as you know, and all the sensory sensitivities can be so you know, negatively impactful on a neurodivergent person, and they may not even be aware of what they're feeling and experiencing. And that's why maybe they dread, you know, the holidays or family get-togethers or birthdays or whatever. And I think I've said this on the podcast before, but I remember, you know, when my ex and my daughter and I used to go to his family's house for the holidays, you know, several times he tried to talk my daughter and I into, it was a long drive, you know, it was like a 13-hour drive to go. We used to fly, and then he decided he wanted to drive because he wanted to have a car there. Now all of this begins to make sense. And he once tried to talk us into going for like 24 hours. Like, you know.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, I got angry. You know, I'm like, I'm not driving for 12 or 13 hours to stay for 24 hours. And now I understand. It wasn't about the lack of love of his family. He, you know, I know he loves his family. It was about having to leave his comfort zone, having to have all these unknowns for an extended period of time, because usually we'd go for 5 days. And it was just, as he got older, I think it was just too much. And I didn't know, because I didn't know we were a neurodiverse family. So thoughts on that?
I sort of think that as we get older, it gets a little bit harder to tolerate, you know, some of the sensory differences. And so I wonder about that. I think that it can be, you know, so stressful. And I personally get really stressed out when the holidays come. And I remember being married, and my kid's father is the opposite. He would love the holidays. He would bring out all the boxes of decorations and be ready to start decorating. And I would have like a heart attack, panic attack, because I needed it done very specifically. And I wasn't in, you know, I didn't have the bandwidth at that moment. And so it would cause a lot of conflict. And there's just so much work that goes into the holidays anyway for everyone, I think, neurotypical and neurodivergent, that I think I've heard it compared to, it's like a part-time job that's sort of, you know, the workload. So there's just so many parts of, you know, what we do with family get-togethers or holidays and bringing in children that are neurodivergent and having this expectation that they'll be well behaved and they'll eat the food that's provided and things will go well. And there's so many different aspects, I think, of how it shows up and causes stressors in addition to what, you know, what you mentioned. So it's interesting. And I think that there is a difference in terms of the amount of time that, you know, some individuals that are autistic, they feel fine. Some people feel fine with just a little bit of a visit, you know, it's about quality, not quantity. So, you know, I think that a lot of different areas pop up in addition to the social anxiety, you know, piece and the reluctance to want to get together and just how that really can show itself. I mean, there's a lot of neurodivergent people who have been very happy under COVID and the pandemic and the work from home.
Yeah. And it totally makes sense. And again, I mean, I took so much personally in my family of origin with my dad. I mean, I was such a people pleaser with him. I put him on a pedestal. The way he came off, he was a psychologist, and, you know, so he had a PhD in psychology. He was a practicing psychologist, and I had him on a pedestal. I thought he could do no wrong. I thought he could say, I didn't think he could say anything that wasn't correct. And then as I got older, I realized a lot of times he was full of shit. my sister and I laugh about it now, but he came off with such an authoritative tone that because he was masking. I mean, he was a fabulous masker. And then the person who he was at home when he was just relaxed and hanging out, or he had a boat and he loved to fish or whatever, was such a different person. And so when we would see some of his patients out at the grocery store or whatever, and they would say how much they loved him and they would describe what they loved about him, my sister and my mom and I would look at each other like, who are they talking about? That is not my dad, you know? And so I know it had to be really difficult for him. And I've shared this on the podcast. He smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. He was truly addicted to Valium. He used to keep the pills in his pockets of his khakis so that he could take them when he needed them. And I think it was really the only way those two things helped him to get through life. And he also was able to change his schedule. So they only worked 3 days a week.
Wow. You know?
And yeah, he worked like 3 8- to 10-hour days, and then he had 4 days off. And I think if he hadn't had that, he wouldn't have been able to continue with his psychology practice for all of his life. I mean, he was still a practicing psychologist when he died, and he had been in that practice since like 1972 or something. So it's so interesting when I view not only my parents and my relationship with them growing up, but my grandparents. I think my maternal grandmother might have been on the spectrum. And I never knew my paternal grandmother, but she may have been too, based on what I heard. So let's talk a little bit about maybe the healing and forgiveness process that we can go through in relation to our parents and other people in our family that may be neurodivergent or were neurodivergent and have passed away. Because when I think about how much hurt, my unintentional hurt and pain my father caused my sister and I, before we both started healing and helping each other heal, it was worse for my sister because he used to scream at her practically every night. And he would scream at her because she would come into the kitchen. I can laugh about it now. And she would get a glass of water, something to drink, something to eat. And he needed to wind down. And he was extremely sensitive to any noise besides the TV. And her coming in and rattling things around, just it drove him nuts. And so he would scream at her, and he was very emotionally abusive to her. I was a scared kid, so I'd make sure not to come into the kitchen, you know, at night and start making noise, you know, and I was a people pleaser. But, you know, I really was not happy with the way he treated my sister, and I never approached him about that. And I think she's healed and I've healed because he was extremely judgmental. And we both understand why now. He had to control his environment. He had to be in control. He never let anybody else drive the car, literally his car or any car. He would drive my car. He would drive his car. He would never let anybody else drive. So he traveled the same route to the airport because we lived in other states for a long time. And so when we would come to visit, he traveled the same exact route always. He never changed his routes.
And wow.
That provided him such comfort, you know, and I couldn't understand it. Even when they built new roads and quicker ways to get to the airport, he wouldn't change. So I think I've healed. I think my sister's healed and forgiven our father for some of the unintentional hurt and pain. How about you? Is that something you've worked on?
That's a great question. I really feel like we have very similar fathers. I remember actually when I was, this is maybe a story I shouldn't share, but I remember when I was probably 10 or 11 years old, my father, I think I shared, he was an attorney, and he gave me his business card and he asked me to go buy him cigarettes. And so I went to the grocery store with his business card and I bought some cigarettes and they sold them to me, which is shocking. But he was a big smoker and he was a big drinker to numb. He was definitely numbing himself so that he could fit in. He really struggled in social situations. He, you know, obviously he wasn't a psychologist, or he didn't have, you know, that those skills. But I remember he would just data dump on law subjects, and he created websites that were just remarkable back, you know, years and years ago. Just it was his interest. And my sister and I, as it turns out, are both pretty sensitive people. And to grow up with someone who was drinking, well, he had some periods of sobriety, which were, you know, enjoyable, but it was hard. It was hard to love someone who would hurt you and mm-hmm. hurt you, you know, not intentionally. And right. so there's that piece of it where, you know, he's not doing it on purpose, but it still hurts.
Right.
And it really can affect your relationships later in life. Right. And so yes. my sister and I have had to do a lot of healing and look at, you know, our relationships and what is okay and what is not okay and not rescuing. Well, I think people kind of turned into rescuers. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's, you have to do a lot of work on that. And I think it's important, but I also have had to do some healing work, just as a person who is not neurodivergent, having autism. I can see, or being autistic. Let me put it that way. I can see how I was incredibly sensitive as a child, and mm-hmm. so a lot of my memories are impacted by that. And there were some experiences that I had that I think really were extra difficult for me, and I don't think I interpreted them in a way that was the way that a neurotypical would, or what an intentional parent was doing. I think I was just really hurt by some things. And so I carried some feelings towards both my parents, some anger, and it required, you know, a lot of introspection once I came out. Mm-hmm. And so that's another topic of, are people in your family able to hear that and receive it and believe it if they don't see it within themselves, or they don't have enough information about it? What does that look like? So to answer, you know, what you mentioned, yes, I've had to do a lot of healing from my own experiences, and to really come to terms with seeing my parents differently. And that's been very, very therapeutic for me. And I feel just grateful. I feel so thankful that I'm able to just look at those old relationships mm-hmm. when I was younger, and just how I can have love and compassion for my parents instead of, you know, lingering anger or frustration or resentments. You know, it's just been an incredible journey for in that way.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I maybe we do have like kindred spirit fathers, because it sounds like, you know, my dad had the Valium, your dad had the alcohol, but, you know, they both were tools that helped them cope and function and be their best selves at work. But we did not necessarily get the best version of them when they were home with us. And it does take a lot of healing, and you do have to forgive. Otherwise, and I say this often on the podcast and in my support groups, that if you're holding on to the anger and the resentment and the judgment and whatever other negative feelings that you have, you will continue to suffer. And the suffering isn't healthy for you, and it probably will lead to some physical ailments or some mental health issues or what have you. So I feel like this is a message mm-hmm. to the audience and the listeners, you know, whatever you need to do to forgive and begin to heal and hopefully recover from any, you know, whether it was emotional abuse or physical abuse or what have you, because a family member did not understand, you know, neurological differences. They didn't understand that they were neurodivergent and they were just trying to cope. If you can't move, you know, forward and do the healing piece, I think that absolutely it's going to affect your life moving forward. And I would love to talk about how it affected my life, how I think it affected how both my ex-husband and I parented and how we were as a couple in some ways. But before I do, I wanted to know if there was anything else you wanted to say about the healing and the forgiveness piece.
I am thinking more about my clients, actually, what comes to mind in regard to so much work that we do around healing and identifying our stress responses. And, you know, I am just thinking about how I see so many individuals with, you know, the fawn response, people pleasing and repressed anger, because it was not okay to use our voice or for them to use their voice, and how that shows up. And it is so helpful to, if you have a family member that gets diagnosed, or if you, someone out there, you know, has a suspicion that a family member is neurodivergent, if you start to look back at, you know, the dynamics and the communication styles that existed, it sheds a lot of light on, you know, some things. And obviously it's not everyone. I mean, this is a select group of individuals, but I think it's so important and critical for healthy relationships and being able to find your voice and be able to ask for your needs to be met in a safe way. And yeah. So my heart actually, you know, hurts a little bit as I'm thinking of, you know, of that, because I know there's a lot of pain and suffering that has been experienced that sort of has been unknown, and it has seemed like it was intentional. And it is, you know, hurt relationships with parents and children and grandparents, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that with all of this information, we will see, you know, changing the generational patterns of misunderstanding and wounds. That
I think that there has been a lot of talk about ending, you know, suffering and trauma with generational healing. And so I think that applies. I think that definitely applies with regard to, you know, the impact of undiagnosed neurodiversity or neurodivergence.
Yeah. I agree. And I think it's really important for the listeners to take this into account. And that is that you may not be able to have safe conversations about this with family members. Because I think that if my father was still alive today, and my sister and I had the conversation with each other about him probably being autistic, I don't think he would be open to that conversation at all. And I think my mother would have been open to the conversation that they were in a neurodiverse relationship or marriage, but I don't think he would have been open to it. And I think it's because of all the pathologizing and, you know, the stereotypes that we see of people who are autistic. So what I would say to the listeners is, when you think that a family member may be autistic or neurodivergent, what is it that you can do to change the way you think about them as you communicate, as you see that they may need some accommodations regarding sensory sensitivities, maybe not taking things personally that they say that are, you know, very blunt or black and white, and, you know, knowing that they don't mean to be hurtful, and maybe asking, okay, well, what did you mean by that? And just having a different kind of relationship with your family member knowing about the neurological differences. What do you think about that?
I think that's very helpful. And if you can educate yourself, I think if anyone's listening to this podcast, they probably are pretty knowledgeable. However, you know, anything you can do to be supportive or not take it personally, and trying to understand that, you know, it's obviously it's not a reflection of you. It's, you know, it's just understanding the potential of neurodivergence that's existing. And it's hard. It's hard to not be able to maybe share something that you've learned about and you think might apply because you have the best of intentions to help. And, you know, you might be met with resistance and maybe some, you know, other sorts of reactions that are not open to, you know, discussing that or exploring it. And I think that it would be beneficial to everyone that is in the family, the children, or anyone who's interacting with that particular individual, if they, you know, are sort of communicating in, you know, in a way that's a little different, or whatever their behavior is.
Yeah. I think that this is really, really important. And the other thing that I want to share before we start talking a little bit about how these family of origin issues may affect your love relationships is that I think it's really important to know what your non-negotiables and boundaries are with your family of origin or your extended family. And I say that because it wasn't okay that my father yelled at my sister for coming in to get a drink or something to eat in the kitchen after 9 o'clock. It wasn't okay. It was very emotionally abusive, and I see that it had and maybe still is impacting her. She has a lot of trauma around that, and I know that, and I watched it, and there was nothing I could do. So, you know, maybe as a child, you can't say to your father or your mother or your grandfather, you know, I'm not okay with you screaming at me, and I'm going to leave this conversation. But there may be, as you get older, things that you can say, and it may start with like a soft startup, I love you. And I can see that you're upset or you're angry or you're bothered by something, but it's not okay for you to talk to me like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to remove myself from this conversation until you're calmer and can talk to me with kindness and respect or something like that. What do you think about the boundaries and the non-negotiable piece?
I agree with you. What comes to mind is that many clients, they're not even aware of the impact or the tone or the volume or the words. And so it can come as a surprise when the other person is offended. Yeah. And so to add to what you're sharing, I would even encourage maybe trying to get safe within yourself so that you can allow yourself to articulate how it's making you feel. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, someone is saying something like, you know, being snapping at you for being loud or something along those lines, in addition to, you know, the boundary, I think if you can help them understand that, you know, that what you just said to me really hurts me that you're talking to me in that way. I hear that as a really, you know, loud complaint or attack. And so it just sort of gives them feedback so that they can understand, because yeah. unfortunately, a lot of situations have happened in people's lives where there's been offense taken or relationships ended, and there's just been confusion and feelings of, you know, inadequacy or failure. And so if we can give feedback to those individuals that are a little harsh with their words or reactive or, you know, accustomed to responding in a aggressive way, I think that kind of helps the situation as well.
Yes. And that's a perfect segue Nicole, and I know you didn't mean to do this, but it's a perfect segue into how all of that we have been discussing can impact your intimate relationships with a romantic partner. And I will tell you that I learned from my father how to yell and scream in my relationship with my ex-husband. I was a screamer, I was a yeller, and that's the way I learned communication happens. And even my mother would yell to my father, you know, they would yell back at each other, and I watched them resolve that conflict and kiss and make up. I don't think I was ever privy to the full repair process, but I saw them doing it over and over again. So that's what I took into my marriage. And when I was separated from my ex-husband, one of the things he said to me that I wish he had said early on in our marriage, because I was communicating the way I thought was appropriate, he said, "Please stop yelling at me." And I said, "Okay." You know, it was that simple. He could have asked me to do that, you know, years ago. And maybe he did, but you know, I didn't hear him the same way I heard him during the separation. I don't know. You know, we were together for 32 years. And I did everything in my power to get, you know, re-regulated and calm before I said something to him. And I don't know that I ever yelled at him again. I may have had a more serious tone, but I knew, I don't remember if we knew that we were a nerdverse couple at the time. We may have, or it may have happened just before that he said that to me, but I understood, Nicole, that for 30 plus years, my screaming was such a dysregulating sensory overload experience for him. And I watched him over and over again, shut down. Literally just shut down and look at me like a deer in headlights. And because my mother was neurotypical, my father could scream at her and she would scream back. And so I took this communication style into my marriage, and it dysregulated and caused so much, you know, probably trauma, but definitely pain, unintentional pain and hurt to my ex-husband. And I've apologized and he's accepted my apology. But gosh, I did that for 30 years, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So anything, you know, any examples that you want to share? Any thoughts on that? Because I have some others too.
Well, I think you don't know what you don't know, right?
Yes.
As soon as
yes.
you know, that's when we're on the hook. So I had a different response. I think that I was more of a fawner. I was afraid to speak out because I didn't want things to escalate, and I would be just so dysregulated as a child because both my parents were yellers. And so in my marriage, I would just people please and just help my partner sort of get, you know, help him calm down. He was highly anxious. And so I would just try to be, you know, I would just hold his anger with him despite my own internal strife mm-hmm. The best that I could. So that resulted in, you know, unfortunately we got divorced because we struggled. We really, really struggled, and things were just so different and we couldn't communicate. I never felt safe expressing my needs or communicating effectively to him because I was afraid of his emotional activation. He was comfortable in that space. I was absolutely not. I was terrified. So, and he was never abusive or anything along those lines. He just, his comfort level of communicating was, you know, in that, that angry. And he, you know, he went to law school too. And so he was, you know, he really leans into that argument and embraced it. And that just did not, you know, work for me. I would shut down. And, so yeah, different experience. And, you know, I wish that I could go back and I wish that I would have known that we were neurodiverse, and I wish there were therapists that could have helped us understand each other. I still absolutely love my ex-husband. We had some really difficult times when we were navigating accommodations for my kids. It was like World War III. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I look back, he's, you know, we were just so different that it, mm-hmm. you know, we couldn't figure out how to make it work. So,
yeah. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. And it sounds like your relationship with your husband, the roles were reversed. And so my ex would shut down, and he did it over and over again until we separated. And then I think the mask came off and he felt that he could, you know, maybe survive and thrive on his own, because he'd never lived on his own before. And he could be very mean to me. And I guess I got a taste of my own, you know, anger and screaming and things that, you know, I had done maybe for 30 years, he was giving me back in that 2.5 year period. And it's not funny, but I'm laughing because it's, I guess it was karma, right? Yeah. And I feel the same way about, you know, my ex-husband. I will always care deeply about him. I may even say that I love him, not in love with him, but we have a child together. You and your ex-husband have 2 children together. You know, my ex-husband and I spent 32 years together. He was my family. You know, I've known him since I was 21. And I think that's important for folks to hear. You know, there is nothing that we can do, Nicole, to go back and change how we experienced our life with our family of origin. We can figure out what we need to do to forgive and to heal and recover. And we cannot go back and change anything that we experienced with our romantic partners, husbands, wives, whatever, when we didn't know we were a neurodiverse couple. We can't go back and change it. I wish we could. I wish I had that magic wand. It ain't gonna happen. You know, and I hear you saying, I wish we had seen therapists that understood neurodiversity, because they would have immediately seen what was happening immediately. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is we can heal, we can recover, we can be better partners as we move forward in new relationships. And I know I've done that. I was a completely different partner to the man that I was in a relationship with after my divorce. I was so different. And I will be different in every relationship that I have moving forward. And I don't know if, you know, you have any thoughts to share about that also.
I do. I hear that your ex-husband had a lot of anger. You know, he was probably stuffing a lot of it during the conflict. And that's something that I related to. I had a lot of anger, and mm-hmm. it took a lot of healing. And I think that that's an issue and a barrier in relationships, where there is that shutdown and there's a yeller, and there's, you know, healing that has to take place before the new skills can be learned. If you go into therapy, you know, neurodiverse relationships, and it can happen, you can heal it. And so I feel, you know, hopeful and lucky that I can work with couples, and I have this knowledge, and I've had this experience, because I'm in a completely different place in my life, that it is nice to be able to hear a dynamic and understand, oh, I think this may be what's happening. You know, what do you think about this? And seeing that relationship just change is mm-hmm. so incredible. And I'm really just so thankful I can be a part of that. But, you know, with my own, you know, my own relationships, they are different. And I'm definitely seeing better communication and expressing needs and just, you know, when you know the outcome, if you don't, you're definitely motivated to work past the discomfort, the initial discomfort. So,
yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that that's so important. It's I think self-awareness, knowing thyself, is so critical. And once we are able to do the work for ourselves and with ourselves, whether we do it with a therapist or we do it on our own or, you know, both or our support system. I think once we have that self-awareness, whether we're neurodivergent, whether we're autistic, whether we're ADHD, whether we're a combo, whether we're neurotypical, it doesn't matter. I think the more self-awareness we have, the more we understand, you know, our wants and our needs in a relationship and what our dreams are for the future. And when we stop, if we're masking, if we're camouflaging, when we're able to maybe slowly take the mask off or stop camouflaging and be honest about what we need in our lives and our relationships, then I do think there is hope, tremendous hope, but it doesn't happen overnight, Nicole, right?
Oh, no. No.
Yeah, it's an ongoing process. It's an ongoing process. And I think as long as I'm on this earth, I mean, I'm 59. And I think as long as I'm on this earth, I'm going to be learning and I'm going to be growing and I'm going to remember things from my family of origin or from my marriage or, you know, a work relationship or something and say, oh, that was because of my ADHD traits. That was because of, oh, that person was probably neurodivergent. Oh, that was when I was going through a lot of depression, you know, and, you know, I can have grace and compassion for myself and others. Mm-hmm. So we're at the end. And of course, another fabulous conversation. And we ended the last episode by talking about a lesson learned. And I can start with one of the lessons that I've learned about my family of origin and how that impacted my relationship with my ex-husband and even with our daughter. I realized that not everybody has the same brain as me, and not everybody wants to talk through things, and not everybody can understand my emotions, and that's okay. It doesn't make me wrong. It doesn't make me better. And it shouldn't make me an angry, bitter person. It did, I think, at times, but it doesn't anymore. And instead, I look for how the differences can be understood. And if I don't know, you know, exactly what's going on, I ask. And I'll say, you know, what do you need at this time? How can I help? What do you need from me? What is, you know, concerning you? What is upsetting you? And maybe the person I'm talking to can't tell me in the moment because they really don't know. But I'll say, you know, let's do a timeout. Let's take a, you know, half hour break and we can come back and, you know, see if we can talk then. 5 years ago, Nicole, 3 years ago, Mona would have never done that in a million years.
Oh, I can relate to that.
So what is your maybe one lesson learned that you want to share with the listeners?
I think that just based on what we were just talking about, patience, that progress, you know, can be made and it takes time. We still may kind of fall into the same hole for a while until we learn how to get out of it or recognize it. And I think that my word of the day right now that I'm loving is acceptance. I think if we can just accept our differences, if we can accept who we are, accept who our partner is or our loved ones who are different, if we can just give that space for everyone to be accepted, I think that that will just by itself make things so much more harmonious.
I agree. And that's a great way to end the podcast. So people know how to reach me. And I think it would be great if you share again how people can reach you if they want to contact you. What is the best way for them to contact you?
I think that I'm going to go with email, if that's okay. Because I'm seeing something. I have a handle on Twitter, but now I'm starting to see that your voluntary handle has to be paid for, which is okay. But I'm just curious to see what's going to go on there. But my email is Nicole M. Knowlton, and that's Nicole M, like Mary, Knowlton, at gmail.com. That is the best way to reach me. I am on Instagram and Twitter at Aspie Therapist. But those are the best ways.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, Nicole. And remember, listeners, Nicole will be back as a guest co-host for a few more sessions. So if there's any topic that you'd like us to address, feel free to send Nicole or I an email, and our emails will be in the show notes. And we'd love to cover other topics that are of interest to all of you. So we look forward to our next conversation together. Nicole, it's always a pleasure.
Great. You too. Thank you so much for having me. It's always
Take care. Bye-bye.